Good evening and welcome to this special Arena Tradfest event celebrating the creative life of one of our great actors, a star of stage and screen, a performer who has been central to the development of Irish theatre and cinema in the past 60 years, Stephen Ray. Tonight's Arena is the first of three shows that we're doing with our friends at Tradfest. We're here in the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan in North County Dublin. Wonderful venue, I must say, my first time here. Absolutely gorgeous. And we have a fine set of traditional music, theatre and film fans sitting out in our audience this evening. With me on stage, of course, is our honoured guest, Tradfest patron, Stephen Ray, as well as a group of performers, many of them friends and long-lasting friends of Stephen. Actress Sinead Cusack, composer and collaborator Neil Martin, and we'll also be hearing from Piper Louise Mulcahy, fiddler Paddy Glacken, and the Lawler sisters who are sitting in the audience at the moment. Sinead, Neil and Paddy will be on stage in the Lark with Stephen during a four-night run of Stephen Ray's celebration as part of Tradfest. There's a lot to talk about in Stephen Ray's life, and we will get to some of it, I hope. But let us start with the thing most of us want to hear from Stephen Ray, a performance. Stephen is going to begin with a poem by his dear friend, Derek Mahon. Very much a piece that speaks to the times we live in. The Derek Mahon piece is called Trump Time. And performing that piece, Stephen Ray, accompanied by Piper Louise Mulcahy.
Nineveh, Tyre, and Carthage are long gone. Also Troy and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Now Britain's empire is a thing of the past, and Anglia too will have an end at last. Oh, not an end, but a slow decline at least. Whitman and Moby Dick, F. Scott Fitzgerald will still be read, Gershwin and Satchmo heard, movies downloaded. But the wider world will think of other things as it did once. Hard rock and carpet bombings will be down. Apple and Goldman Sachs down with the rest. Some peace and quiet once again in evidence. Where a spring rises in the little wood of birch and sycamore beside the house, I stand and listen to the undying source whispering there. I'd travel, if I could, through the lost ages to a distant time when it was sacred to a pre-Christian God. I'd tie a token on a thorn and climb back to the present, sure in the belief we can still touch the origins of life. Relish perspective, silence, solitude, far from the bedlam of acquisitive force that rules us and would rule the universe. Such things survive, beloved of poet and artist, only where their despoilers haven't noticed, in a yard or a hidden cove out on the edge, the rushy meadow and the fallow acre ripe for development as industrial plant, serving as temple, shrine and sepulchre. These places minister to the soul by dint of radiating a strange air of privilege. And here we live, not in a petulant rage for world dominion, but an inner continent of long twilights shrouded in mist and rain. The lasting features of our lost domain.
Louise Mulcahy on pipes and the voice of Stephen Ray there reading Trump Time by Derek Mahon. The event tonight, Stephen, a collaboration with Tradfest, of which I've said you are a patron, and so beloved a patron are you that they're doing a whole series of events to celebrate you. I know you love the spotlight, so I know that you're dying to get to all of those events. However, we're delighted that you're here with us this evening.
Thank you.
I was picking up on a line in that Derek Mahon poem, which talks about standing and listening to an undying source. At what point did traditional music become one of those undying sources that you might stand and listen to?
Well, look at how wonderful it felt for me to be standing with Louise, playing along with that beautiful poem by Derek, you know. And there's Neil Martin,
who's on stage with us here as well.
Yes, I've worked with, you know, with language and music for a long time. So it's just not avoidable, you know. It's beautiful, and I feel very, very fortunate to be with these people.
And in the Belfast of the 50s and 60s, when you were growing up, born in the mid-40s, so I guess from about the 50s onwards, you might be aware of stuff, or been aware of stuff around you. Was traditional music part of that milieu in any way?
Well, it wasn't as bad as Dublin, where they were trying to forget it, you know. But there was some music around, and of course then there was the famous McPeaks, who were not secretive, but you would say private, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he learned pipes from them.
Neil, yeah.
And when I first heard them play, well, I was blown away, you know. I mean, you couldn't. Two sets of pipes and a harp. Three men, you know, me, my dad, and James. And they were, weren't they? They were out of this world.
What kind of age would you have been at that time?
Well, I think I was about 17 or 18.
So it was into your teens, really, yeah?
Yes, into my lovely teens.
They're lovely for all of us, I think it's safe to say. You did go to study in Queen's, you studied English. When did acting then start to creep up the back of your...
Oh, it had crept in long before then.
You were reading out loud to yourself, was it, as a child?
I read everything I could about theatre and everything, and I read, at a very early stage, I read all the plays that I could find.
So you were reading plays from a very early stage, but
yeah.
as a young child reading, I believe you loved reading out loud, and I guess doing the voices.
I did love reading out loud. I've always loved it, you know, and I hate to say, I'm sorry, but at school I always got asked to read more than once because the other guys were hopeless.
All of whom are phoning into the programme right now to tell you just how good they were. however, obviously, the music was always there as part of the cultural milieu that you were in. Certainly acting in theatre, as you've explained to us, was there too. You had thought about going to a drama school in England, but what changed your mind and what sent you to the Abbey?
I went over to do an audition for Central School of Drama, and I was waiting for at Lime Street Station in Liverpool, and I collapsed and was taken to the hospital, and I said, this, I'm going home.
Divine intervention, would you reckon?
Yeah, I would say it was, yeah.
So back you came to the Abbey, but I think there was it Francis Tumulty's father who kind of nudged you in the direction of the Abbey, or certainly made you more aware of it?
Well, Joe Tumulty was a great figure in Belfast, and he'd had a terrible accident and couldn't work anymore, but I would go to his house and he would talk about theatre, Irish theatre, everything, and he was really a brilliant advisor on that. And so then I'd read a lot about W.B. Yeats and his work in the Abbey, and which was as an important an option for independence as any war that we had, really.
Well, it was very much a cultural revolution at the time.
And yeah, so then that's when I decided. So
off you went down to the Abbey, which, Sinead, I think was the very first time, was it, that you met Stephen, would have been in the Abbey. Was it as Banff, as the Banff Prince in the pantomime, or did you meet him even before that?
Well, I think I might have met him before I played my famous Bond Prince. I was one of the worst Bond Princes ever. Steve, come on. I was the worst. They used to have a singing prince and princess in the traditional Irish pantomime that they'd have every year at the Abbey. But the year that Steve and I and Donal McCann were part of the company, they decided to have an acting, if you can call me an acting princess, an acting princess and prince. And I couldn't sing for toffee. I really, really couldn't. Steve has a beautiful singing voice. He might have not told people this, but he does.
No doubt he will share it with us before the evening is out.
No, he won't.
Yes, he should. Yeah. He doesn't do enough of it.
But at that period, you mentioned Donal McCann and yourself and Stephen were there. I mean, that was, Stephen, a really productive time in the Abbey.
Yes, it was. But I think that those three actors you mentioned weren't particularly valued by the management. I mean, some years later, we did O'Casey's play Shot of a Gunman. And
this was in the Abbey, was it?
BBC.
All right.
Television.
We were all living in London at that time, and Donald played Seamus Shields. I played Donald Averill. And
I played Minnie.
She played Minnie. And, you know, when I looked at it, I thought, well, this should have been the Abbey company. You know, but we were not. Perhaps Donal got a certain amount of regard, but it was they weren't running it for the actors. That's what I'm saying.
And when you went, and I think a lot of the work you did when you moved to England then in the 70s, a lot of it was in the Royal Court. Was that more of an acting-led theatre at that time?
Yeah, I loved the Royal Court, and they were passionate about new plays. They were always doing new plays. Mm. It's just really what the Abbey used to be, you know, and it was a great place to go. And actually there was a picture there of Peter Gill, white-haired man, who was a brilliant director, and he gave me my first job in the Royal Court. Yeah.
And what was that?
It was a play called, I Forget Everything.
Sounds like a great title for a play.
Famous Beckett play, I Forget Everything.
It was about a prisoner of war camp, and we were all playing soldiers, but it was very funny.
Yeah, you mentioned the picture that's the audience here in the Lark, our concert hall, are seeing part of an exhibition, in fact, that's showing here as part of the celebration as well, pictures of you and your various acting roles throughout the years. Freedom of the City, the Brian Friel play, was done in the Royal Court at that time with Albert Finney.
Albert Finney directed it, yeah.
And was that what first brought you into, again, were you surprised that that was going on in London rather than in Ireland?
Well, it was going on in the Abbey as well. Mm. But what Albert was, it was about Bloody Sunday, you know, in Derry, and it was by Brian Friel, and that's when I first met Brian Friel. And why I love Albert was
they were offered this play to do, and Albert said, I'll direct it and I'll do it now. We have to do it now because this is happening now. Mm. And I thought that was a wonderful response from an Englishman, you know. Mm. And but of course, a lot of people didn't come.
Yeah.
And we came off early, but the statement was made, you know.
And I guess that was as important as anything else. And it did, I suppose it was the beginnings of what would become Field Day Theatre Company.
Brian and I hit it off big time.
Yes, you were on. That period, Sinead, in London and in London theatre, particularly the Royal Court, it just seemed to be one more experimental and provocative play after another. Not just provocation for the sake of provocation, but really powerful political dramas.
Mm. It was a very important time in London. And that was the Royal Court was the focal point for that sort of innovative new work. And Max Stafford Clarke, who was running it at the time, he took almost pride in the audiences that left in the middle of some of the plays, because they were political and important pieces of work that were being done there. And then to put Brian, who was very much part of my childhood, because his wife was a cousin of my mother's, so we used to see Brian a lot in our childhood. And to see his play going on there was a source of great pride.
And did you become aware of Stephen's work as an actor then in London during his period there?
I watched his work very carefully to see how he was doing, you know, because I had a sort of protective feeling towards him. And then I watched the stellar rise of his career
and
envy.
The protective feeling went away. But it really was Stephen.
Spectacular.
Yeah, it was a spectacular career. You were talking about the Freedom of the City there. It was around this time, too, that you met Samuel Beckett. Through Jack McGowan, in fact.
Jack, yeah. Well, Jack had given me my first job in London in Shadow of a Gunman, playing Tommy Owens. And Jack was very famous for his work in Beckett. And then he unfortunately died when they were doing Endgame, and they invited me to take his role.
Yeah, and that meeting with Beckett, which I think was formative, definitely in this, if there's such a thing as a style of acting of Stephen Ray, but it was formative, I think, in the way you approach acting.
Oh, very much so, you know, because his attitude was, don't think about meaning, think about rhythm, and that's the only note I would give anybody. Don't do your head worrying about what it means.
And ambiguity, I think he encouraged ambiguity.
Ambiguity, yeah. We said, it's always ambiguous.
And how did he go about saying that to you? I mean, it must have being in the room with Samuel Beckett, even thinking about it, I think, would make me petrified.
Yeah, I was kind of petrified, all right, yeah. But listen, I'd been invited into the Beckett world, and I was inhabiting the role that my former mentor, Jack, had played. It was huge for me. And so I allowed myself a little fear and a little nerves, because it was a big learning experience.
And it was around this time, too, I think, that you met Sam Shepherd, another great Beckett fan, and a playwright not a thousand miles in style from Beckett in some ways.
Well, he was totally influenced by Beckett. I actually worked with him before I worked with Beckett. And he was madly jealous that I got to work with Beckett before he did, you know.
And that aspect of Beckett and the Irish voice, how would you explain that? Because I've often heard Beckett productions where when you hear Irish actors in it, suddenly it's opened up in a way that you don't necessarily have it opened up to you in other accents.
Well, you know, the perfect one is Jack, you know, and McGee, although he had a rather, developed English artificial style.
Patrick McGee, who played, he played
Ham.
Ham in the Endgame that you're talking about.
And he played Crab's Last Tape. It was written for him. He was a wonderful actor, actually. The best performance I've ever been on stage with was in Endgame. He was phenomenal. But as I say, to be introduced into that world with those guys was very special.
All right, we're going to get another performance from you now. So I'm going to ask Louise Mulcahy to come back out on stage now. I'm going to ask Neil and Stephen to move over to the I have it here for you.
Thank you.
To move over to the performance microphone, where they're going to perform from Neil's piece, in fact, Ocean Child, a sad and tragic story of the sinking of the RMS Taylor in 1854, not far from where we are right now. Neil Martin's composition is a work for narrator and musicians, including Neil and Louise Mulcahy, and will be performed here at the Lark Concert Hall as part of Tradfest on Friday, January the 24th. So here we have Ocean Child, and Stephen will start with a part of the script which really sets for us the whole, I suppose, the story that's been told here.
The RMS Taylor was a White Star Line iron-hulled clipper that set sail on her maiden voyage from Liverpool on January the 19th, 1854, bound for Australia. With five classes of accommodation, she was built and fitted out to a high degree of luxury within a surprisingly short period of time. Many of the passengers were tempted to Australia in the hope of a new and better life, and had chosen the Taylor because of the reputation and experience of her captain, John Noble. He was lauded for his recent 13-month record-breaking voyage from Liverpool to Australia, onto China, and back home via New Orleans and the West Indies. The voyage was expected to take around 3 months, but 2 days into her journey, she ran aground onto Lambay Island with the loss of hundreds of lives. There had been no sea trial before the ship left port, and there were questions about her crew, the ropes, the rudder, the rigging, the masts, the anchor chains, the captain, and crucially, the three compasses that, on account of the iron hull, were displaying a considerable disparity between them. Passenger and crew lists weren't as accurately recorded or monitored at that time, and reports and accounts vary as to the numbers on board. Some records claim there were 652 on board, whereas at the inquest it was stated that there were 576. Some claim 294 souls were lost, including 56 children and 13 infants. Others claim that 370 lives were lost. Definitive numbers we are unlikely to ever know. What we do know is that it was a tragedy of colossal proportions.
Thank you.
Ocean Child, composed by Neil Martin and narrated by Stephen Ray, with music from Neil and Louise Mulcahy, will be at Tradfest here in the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan on Friday, January the 24th. Tradfest.com for more information there. I do want to get on to the film stuff, but I obviously can't not talk about Field Day Theatre Company when I talk about your theatre career. Okay. I mean, how, when you started talking about those plays in the Royal Court and their political content, how much did politics, I think, do you think, inform what Field Day wanted to do?
Well, it was inevitable, really. You know, the first play we did was Translations by Brian Friel, which when I went to speak to him about forming a company, that's the play he was working on. And look, we were in a hugely political situation at that time. There was hunger strikes, were, it was rough, you know. Culture is another way of approaching things. I'm not saying it's the only way, but it's another way. And we, the vibe around Translations was sensational, and people started to think about their own history again. You know,
cast included Liam Neeson and Ray McAnally.
Yes,
first cast.
I know, and Mick Lally as well. Hmm. And, yeah, it was good.
And it was Field Day Theatre Company, Neil, that brought you a little bit later on from Translations, that brought you into the realm of Stephen and that particular aspect of theatre.
Yeah, 1988, there was a performance in the Guildhall in Derry, and words and music, and Davy Hammond, who was on the board, who was a pal of mine, asked if I would come up and play some music in the Guildhall, and that was, I mean, what a buzz for a young fella at that stage to share the stage with Heaney and Friel and Paulin, and you know.
Yeah, and you know, for you as an artist, watching somebody like Stephen, who had had real international standing and fame at that point in time.
Yes, and I mean, I was a big fan of Field Day and all that Stephen had done and all that Field Day had done from beforehand, so it was a huge buzz. And then the following year, I was asked to be musical director and compose music for a play by Terry Eagleton, St. Oscar, that was directed by the late Trevor Griffiths, that we all collaborated with in
and
various times.
Stephen played Oscar Wilde.
He did, he did. And he was very fetching.
One of the criticisms that was levelled at Field Day early on, in particular, Stephen, was this idea of it having a nationalist philosophy. Do you agree with that criticism, or is there a problem with it?
Well, you know, that's the trouble with the North, is that they judge everything in a sectarian way. And what we were doing was not offering a rigid political philosophy, but we were doing plays where you could decide what you thought. That's the great thing about art and culture, and It's not heavy-handed. It's subtle, and so, I mean, of course, if you watch Translations, you can't avoid feeling sympathetic for the people who've been deprived of their language, which was thousands of years older than the language that was being replaced with. You know, of course, and we will continue to be annoyed about that.
And I'm sure you will give me some more annoyance in the next half hour of the programme as well when we move into your film career. We'll be back with more from the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan after this break. And welcome back to this Arena Tradfest special, live from the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan, where we're celebrating the creative life of actor Stephen Ray. Now, we're going to move from discussing the stage career into the film shortly, Stephen. I don't know what we have to not talk about in this to get a good sense of it. I mean, even if I just mentioned The Crying Game, The Butcher by Michael Collins, three of the films you made with Neil Jordan, that would be a body of work for many people, but there's so many besides that. But before we get into all of that, we're going to have another piece of music from two local sisters. They go by the name The Lawler Sisters. They are Cianet and Edith, you'll never guess what, Lawler. They're fiddler players from Rush in County Dublin, students at Cailleach de Glór na Mara in Balbriggan, and they're going to play a reel for us, The Star of Munster. Monster, played by the Lawler sisters, Edith and Kenneth. And that really proves to you, Stephen Ray, we are still with me on stage, are Stephen Ray, Sinead Cusack and Neil Martin. And that really proves to you that it is an undying source and that traditional music will continue into the new generation, because the two girls are young women at this point.
I know. Well, I mean, what traditional music is doing at the moment is so innovative and passionate, you know, and right out there. Nobody's ashamed of it anymore. It was absolutely magnificent.
It was gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
Beautiful stuff indeed. As I said, Stephen, I want to move on and talk a little bit about the film career. I think it's fair to say that your collaboration with director Neil Jordan, your many collaborations with director Neil Jordan, has been most fruitful, but in particular, The Crying Game from 1992, which was such a groundbreaking film when you think of it now. It seems easy now in 2025. Mm-hmm. But you had worked with Neil before that on Angel.
That was his first film and my first film.
Yeah. And have you watched that in recent times? Do you go back and watch it?
I watched it maybe 2 years ago in a festival, you know. And it's just excruciating to watch yourself, really, you know. But
I watched it. I watched it about a week ago. And I'd seen it before. But I was absolutely taken with Steve's work and Neil's work. Mm. But to watch the young Stephen on screen, there's something about Stephen's work on screen. Now, don't be embarrassed by this, but he holds secrets, and you always want to find out what he's thinking. And he can do compassion and cruelty almost on the turn of a sixpence. It's amazing, really, as a first movie.
Yeah, and it was the story of this young saxophonist who witnesses the murder of a young girl, a young deaf mute, and it's the manager of the venue, isn't it, or his own manager, and he sees the murder, and that leads them into all sorts of areas. But at that time, was it around then that Neil Jordan started to tell you about, I have this other idea?
No, I didn't. That was for a good way. He did a film called Company of Wolves.
Oh, yes, and you were part of that, too.
Actually, if you look at it now, it's a really great film. But then he did a couple of other ones without me, and they weren't any good.
Can I ask you, Steve, just about the playing of the sax?
Yes.
You know, the character was called the Stan Getz of South Armagh, and Steve is absolutely credible.
Well, I was taught by a wonderful saxophone player called Keith Donald.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful guy. And actually,
Moving Hearts players. We played with Moving Hearts, I think, along the way, didn't he? A lot of the time, yeah.
Wonderful player. But he did the recordings that I mimed to, you know.
Right.
And he taught me all the tricks of the finger saxophone and all that, you know. And at the same time, Robert De Niro had just done a movie called... I forgot what it's called, where he played a saxophone player. And they were all saying, oh, he's as great as Charlie Parker and all that, you know. And I thought, this is... And I said to Keith, what am I going to do? You know, De Niro is supposed to be better than Charlie Parker. And he said, I've got a copy of the film. I'm going to look at it. And he came in the next morning. He says, I saw the film. You've got nothing to worry about.
And Sean, if I might interject, I saw Stephen before I met him being a trombone player, imitating miming.
Oh, in Pentecost,
in Pentecost. And I was convinced, and I'm a muso by profession, I was convinced this man was playing because all the slides, all the movements were so accurate. But that goes to underline what Sinead was saying earlier. This man is a terrific musician. He just happens to wear a coat of an actor. But he's a seriously great sense of music. And I'm sure that stands in his theatre work as well.
And as you said about theatre work and this idea that rhythm is more important than meaning, Stephen, I suppose, does that transfer into the film world, that musicality? Are you totally dependent on the script in that regard and the director?
I don't know. Sometimes I think when I've been on stage, I wish I had a close-up here because I wouldn't do anything. I would just think, you know. And that's true, isn't it? And that's what film allows you to do. You know, they can come to you for a shot and you can just be considering. You can't do that in a theatre. No, you know, that has to, you have to describe what you're feeling and things.
Like. Yeah, you have to project it out for the person down in the back row of the audience. Yeah, yeah. The person exactly. Who's getting the close up in the front row. But The Crying Game, Neil Jordan did come to you with it. At a time, it was called The Soldier's Wife.
Yes, it was. What a bad title, really.
Well, it gave too much away for starters. Well, no, it didn't give it away. Yeah, that's right.
Well, you see, he didn't send me a script. He just told me the story. And will I reveal the secret?
Well, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen The Crying Game, go up and go over and turn on the kettle. It'll be noisy by the time Stephen gets to telling you what happens.
No, well, he has a scene with this beautiful young woman, and then he goes back to her apartment and discovers that, in fact, she's a man. Don't be so shocked.
But in 1982, that was
truly
shocking.
It was huge. Very shocking.
In 1992, sorry. Yeah.
No, it was huge. And as Neil says himself, you couldn't make that film now because it's all out in the open. Mm. The whole trans thing and everything, you know.
But he was using that sexuality and gender studies, as well as the fact that the woman that he goes to meet in London is the wife of the soldier that he has held. Fergus, your character, has been holding this black British soldier as hostage, and that doesn't go well. And even though they become great friends. But Neil Jordan was kind of looking at Northern Ireland and nationalist politics and Irish politics in a very unusual and complex way.
Yeah, I like the way you separate Northern Ireland and Ireland, you know. That says a lot about your politics.
Oh, and we're off.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is that everything he was doing in that film was about identity, you know, challenging, you know, fixed ideas of identity. And that's what fascinated people, because it wasn't, it made everything less narrow, you know. And it's a truly tremendous piece of work. I saw it a couple of years ago, where there was a new thing of it, and I just said, I wasn't going to watch it, but I watched it, and then I said to Neil, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, and it still holds all this.
The thing is, he's an extraordinary filmmaker, and I think he was ahead of the game in the first few films, and now the film world has caught up with him, and so he has to reinvent himself in some way. But he's an absolutely brilliant artist.
Is that the same for an actor? Does an actor have to invent him or herself every performance, effectively?
Hopefully, yes. But I only find that, you know, that Neil's films, when I've been in them, allow you room to invent yourself, you know? I mean, I did a film, a Graham Greene film.
The Remains of the Day. Yeah. I'd say The End of the Affair.
End of the Affair. And I didn't want to do it because he wanted me to play the husband. And I said, I don't really want to play an old loser of a cuckold, you know. But we somehow worked more passion into it than that, you know. And that's the thing. He is a wonderful man to work with. You know.
And you have worked on film, Sinead, with Stephen on a couple of occasions, yeah?
I have, yeah. We did we did a film, an improvised film, you know, in the manner of...
Very much like a Mike Lee type
Mike
thing, wasn't
Lee,
it? Yeah,
exactly. A director called Les Blair. So we improvised for, I think it was about 10 weeks or something, in a carpet factory in Kilburn, where we all had to invent our characters. And I do remember Steve and I, who were playing husband and wife, and we were sent out by Les Blair into Camden Town to select sanitary ware. Now, do you know what that means?
I think I have an idea.
The wash basin, the toilet,
yes.
etc. So do you remember being sent out? And we had to stay in character. We were supposed to stay in character while we were out there choosing. Steve and I just couldn't keep a straight face. I mean, it was ridiculous. But I loved the movie, and I loved working with him. And then we did V for Vendetta, which that one was called Bad Behavior.
The first one, yeah.
Yeah. And then we did V for Vendetta, which had a lot more attention paid to it than poor old Bad Behaviour. But I loved it.
I'd say you loved that improvisation and method style of acting, Stephen. Finding intentions and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I didn't mind. But, what was good about it was at the time when the Irish were a dubious entity.
Yeah.
And we were playing very middle-class people. And, you know, you could, and even though you had, as you always do, a copy of the Proclamation, 1916 Proclamation, on the wall, it still was, the film was kind of saying, you know, these people are really like you guys.
Yeah, they're human.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was wonderful to be able to be ourselves,
yeah.
Which he allowed us to be.
Which is what Neil Jordan had done in The Crying Game, humanising all of these various people from various backgrounds and with various identities. I don't know which of the other films of Neil Jordan. Michael Collins, who you played Ned Broy, who's a kind of a conglomeration of people in the Dublin Castle at around the time of Michael Collins was there. How important, because the biggest criticism that was thrown at Michael Collins was the whole idea of historical accuracy. How important is that, or how do you handle that when it comes to an historical film?
Oh, well, everybody will feel differently about it, won't they, really? I mean, I think the great excitement of Michael Collins was that we were doing it here in Dublin ourselves on the street with loads of people as extras, and they weren't getting paid. They were given, bottles of whiskey, and they were being rewarded. But they were being rewarded anyway for acting out their own story. I mean, it's got to be better than a Hollywood version of Irish history, you know. And so it was very exciting for that reason. And I've said this to Neil, you know, I would have liked more emphasis on the treaty and how compromising it was. It was very much about a kind of personality issue between Michael Collins and De Valera and everything, and I think it was bigger than that, you know.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the whole idea of partition, which created those two words that I misused earlier on in the programme, just to clarify. We'll be back with more from the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan after this break. And welcome back to the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan and this special Arena Tradfest celebration of the actor Stephen Ray. Actor and better saxophonist. Yes, okay, we'll let that one go as well. Also, still with us is Sinead Cusack and Neil Martin, and just joining us over on the far side of the stage are fiddle player Paddy Glacken, and Louise Mulcahy is back there as well, because we're going to finish up with a piece of music. I've only skimmed the surface, really, Stephen, when I speak about what you've done in terms of theatre and in terms of film. When you look at what you've done, what's your feeling around it? And I know you're a great man for self-deprecation and for not actually acknowledging what you might have achieved, except when you're being, you know, sarcastic about yourself.
Well, I've got the fortunate thing that because actors always work with writers, I can always praise or blame the writer, you know. But and I've worked with great writers. Or great writers have chosen me, which is very flattering. But if Neil wanted me to do anything, I'd do it, you know.
Neil Jordan,
And I did things with Friel that I thought I maybe wasn't right for even, you know, but I did them because he wanted me to do them. I've worked with, you know, and actually I've worked with a great, great new Belfast, newish. Belfast
I was going to ask
writer.
You about David Ireland.
David Ireland.
Yeah.
He's a staggering writer, you know, a very important writer.
Talk to us a little bit about his piece, Cypress Avenue, which is very interesting given that David Ireland himself comes, as he's a card-carrying unionist.
Well, he is, and he says so, but that's, and he's not ashamed of it. But the thing is, it means that he's not ashamed to criticise it big time. And the criticism of the lead character in that is, I mean, the guys on on the verge of madness and actually teeters over into it. But
this is Eric Miller, the character that you played in the production, who believes that his granddaughter, isn't it?
He believes that his granddaughter is Gerry Adams.
And that causes him some
trouble.
Don't
you think that's funny? No, but it's mad. But it's like King Lear, where, you know, the guy becomes a gigantic figure who kills his family. And I just love the courage of David to write that way. And not just courage, the ability.
And, of course, Sam Shepherd was another great, important playwright within your life, given that when the Derry City of Culture came into play again, you invited him back to Field Day, in fact, back to Derry to do a play with Field Day.
Yeah, I did. I had a phone call with him. I said, Sam, would you come to Derry and do a play for the City of Culture? And he said, sure.
and he did. He wrote it.
He did. He said, would you want me to, as I say, a rude word, but he says, shall I write to some particular theme or will I just write it balls out? You can cut that out.
It's live, Stephen.
What?
It's live.
Well.
So we won't be cutting it out.
I'm sorry. I apologize to the Lawler girls, you know.
He chose the latter
word. I said, I think you should do it balls out.
Second apology.
I don't know.
Another thing that I just wanted to touch on before we finish up and go to the final piece of music, Neil, is a piece that I remember seeing you and Stephen do in the Kilkenny Arts Festival. Is it eight years ago, maybe at this point, around about that?
2016, the first one we did, yeah.
It was the poetry of the final poem, in fact, the final translation of Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, Aeneid Book 6. And it was an extraordinary experience. And every time we've done it subsequently, you hear something else, you know, because it's such an extraordinarily beautifully written piece of work. And Heaney, like a lot of great writers, had great music in him as well. So it's not that much of a challenge to find the rhythm, and the pulse and the melody within Heaney's words that then I play on cello as Stephen reads the poem. Yeah,
and in the poem that you read for us at the top of the program, Trump Time from Derek Mahon, again we had and within a lot of Heaney's work we have these references to classical mythology and how that might inform us in contemporary society.
Well, that's the thing, is that a lot of our poets are, you know, have been classically educated, and I think that can only be good, you know?
Hmm.
I don't know. They stopped teaching Latin and stuff, haven't they? It seems a pity, really, because everything is based on it, isn't it, you know?
For you, Sinead, what would you like to celebrate, which is what we're doing this evening, celebrate most about Stephen Ray?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, because he's a multifaceted human being, our Steve. So as an actor, I admire him hugely. But as a human being, I am constantly surprised that such a serious man can be so ridiculously funny. So I'm just saying that about him.
And sometimes just so ridiculous.
So ridiculous. And embrace the ambiguity of Steve. Yeah.
There we are, back to a word that we used early on, ambiguity. In fact, I think Neil Jordan went further. He said that you could play three emotions at the one time.
Did he say so?
He did say, yeah.
There you go.
I don't know if I've got three emotions.
Annoyed, more annoyed, and very annoyed.
Well, that'll be it.
And for you, Neil? A long time collaboration with Fiona.
Yeah,
well, a big part of this.
Stephen and I are working together upwards of 40 years at this stage. I just want to do more. We were talking about it backstage this evening, and I said, let's just keep doing more. Why would we stop something that's so pleasurable? Keep on doing it.
All right.
I'll let you... Oh, no, before I go to that, let me go to Paddy Glacken, who's across the stage from us at this time. As we say, there's a whole set of celebrations around Stephen Ray. On Wednesday, Stephen will read poetry in the company of Felly Speaks and Paul Muldoon. On Thursday, January the 23rd, Stephen will be in conversation with Sinead Cusack, on the subject of acting. On Friday the 24th, a performance of Neil Martin's Ocean Child. And on Saturday, you'll be on stage yourself, Paddy, for a concert called Stephen Ray, A Celebration, Songs and Tunes New Strong.
What a lineup that particular piece has.
Well, it's going to be a very, very interesting evening because it's a lot of old tunes reimagined, particularly by Neil Martin here. He's put a different sort of a shape onto them. They are tunes that are very, very... We would probably regard them as classical tunes in the traditional idiom, tunes like Teller I Am or the Monaghan Jig. So they're going to be reimagined. So we're looking forward to that. I'll be playing in the company of Matt Malloy, Derek Hickey and Myron Yagonan will be singing some of old songs from Ranafast, which again have been reimagined by Neil. So it's going to be a good evening.
Yeah, have you been involved in the choosing of the songs in any way, Stephen? So you're going to be as surprised as...
Oh, they just do what they want.
Yeah, no consultation at all.
No.
Do you feel at 3, 2.5 minutes to 8 o'clock, duly celebrated?
Well, I do really. I mean, this is extraordinary. It's not a situation that you find yourself in very often, you know. And with the genius of these musicians, you know. No, I was thinking of a phrase earlier, you know, Níl gan ceol.
Níl saol gan ceol, yeah. And yeah. There is no life without music. Well, let us finish then with some music, but before we do that, let me say some thanks, obviously, to Stephen Ray himself for being with us this evening. Also to... Yeah. To Sinead Cusack and Neil Martin for their illuminations on the great Stephen Ray. And to our several musicians, the Lawler sisters, Neil himself, Louise Mulcahy and Paddy Glacken. And we're going to... But that is it from this special Stephen Ray celebration from Arena and Tradfest. We'll be back with Tradfest, two shows from the Print Works at Dublin Castles on January the 20th and 21st. Lots of glorious live music for you there. My thanks to all at the Lark Concert Hall here in Balbriggan, particularly led by Breda McCarthy. For RTE, our sound team was Gar Duffy, Damien Gavigan and Harry Buchlis back at bass. The researcher for tonight's programme was Paula Shields. The broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton and the programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Let's go over to our house band, Neil Martin, Paddy Glacken, Louise Mulcahy, to play us out with two jigs. Remember, tradfest.com for all the details of everything happening at the festival. The two jigs that we're about to hear, Munster Buttermilk and Sweet Biddy Dailies.